Are educational reforms like high-stakes testing failing our schools?
High-stakes standardized tests, when you tie a lot of adult accountability measures for teachers and principals to scores on these tests, basically what you're creating is a system in which test prep can become the de facto curriculum in schools. And this especially happens in poor children's schools because those are the schools that are under the most pressure politically to raise test scores. And so this is just a simple situation of perverse incentives.
That's Dana Goldstein. We talk with her about her fascinating history of school reform in the U.S., and the battles over teaching, then and now. It's called The Teacher Wars, a history of America's most embattled profession. Then we check in with Katrina Vandenheuvel for a short clip from our interview with her about her interview with Edward Snowden. Our whole discussion is on our newly designed website, writersvoice.net. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's tough to be a teacher in America today. Teachers are blamed for failing students and failing schools, most often by the very politicians who are busy slashing funding for public schools and cutting the social supports poor students need to succeed. But controversies over education in America are not a new thing. They've been raging for almost two centuries. And teachers have ever been at the center of those battles, fighting for respect for their profession and for the chance to do what they feel is right for their pupils. In her book, The Teacher Wars, my guest, Dana Goldstein, finds answers in the past to the controversial questions that plague our public schools today. Who should teach? What should be taught? And who should be held accountable for how children learn? She finds that many of the solutions being pushed today, like high-stakes testing, ranking and firing veteran teachers, and bringing in elite college grads to teach, have already been tried and found wanting. Goldstein argues that instead of undermining public school teachers, we should be supporting their professional development, drawing on the best practices of America's best teachers to foster better learning by students. She also says that privatized educational solutions are no substitute for tackling the real roots of school failure, poverty and inequality. Dana Goldstein has been reporting on public education since 2007. She's a staff writer at the Marshall Project and writes for such venues as The Atlantic and Slate. The Teacher Wars is published by Doubleday. Well, Dana Goldstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Teacher Wars, the subtitle of this is A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. You point out on the first page that no other profession operates under this level of political scrutiny. Why do you think teachers have been so much the target of political scrutiny, such a political football?
Well, looking back over 200 years, I found that this sense of the teaching profession being embattled or controversial is not new. And what I really came away with were two big explanations for why teaching is such a controversial profession. The first one, I think, has to do with the fact that we have extremely high expectations for teachers. And that's as it should be. Of course, they're spending the day with our children, and what more important responsibility could there be? But it really goes beyond that, which is that in the United States, we've historically had quite a weak social safety net outside of our schools. So we've tasked teachers again and again from the 19th century till today with closing gaps between white children and black children, between poor children and middle-class children, between immigrants and the American mainstream. And because this is quite a difficult task, and we have this high expectation for teachers, unfortunately, teachers have sometimes appeared to have failed at this huge responsibility that we've given them. The second reason why teaching is embattled and controversial, especially today, is that it is a unionized profession. And because of that, teachers have certain benefits and job security protections that have become quite unusual, even though they weren't always so unusual in the American economy. But currently, only about 7% of private sector workers are in unions. So teaching looks sort of peculiar compared to other jobs.
That's a sad comment, I'd have to say, on American labor. And unionization is part of that issue. But before we get to talking about how unions began, as you say, this struggle has been going on for a long time, and the themes of educational reform have come up again and again. There are kind of two poles to the themes of education reform, poles that we have oscillated to back and forth throughout history, of progressivism on the one hand, and then the strict accountability on the other.
Yeah, well, often we've had the idea that we should hold teachers accountable for student outcomes, whether that's measured by test scores or some other way, and that we need to get tough and strict on teachers. And I would argue that this is the dominant movement, actually, in American education. And there's always been voices from the corner, say, that are out there with a different vision, and that could be called progressive education, and it's affiliated with thinkers like John Dewey, like Ella Flagg Young, who is a wonderful woman educator in turn of the century Chicago, who I profile briefly in the book. But this is more of a vision about improving the interactions between the child and the teacher, you know, making them more intellectually rigorous, making sure that children are not just rote learning, but asking bigger questions and taking field trips and art and music. And these two visions, sometimes they work in tandem, but usually not. Typically, they are in opposition to one another.
Why do you think that's so?
Well, if you're going out into school reform with the mission of holding teachers accountable, you're going to look for ways to do that, ways to evaluate who's the better teacher and rank and rate. And historically, the easiest, cheapest, simplest way to do that is to use student test scores. So when you're using test scores to hold adults accountable and you're creating systems that impact tests and hold tests very important, it's difficult to do some of those progressive things. It's difficult to spend a lot of time on field trips or art and music if the whole system is oriented toward creating higher standardized test scores at the end, because when adults are incentivized to raise student test scores because their own job security is attached to those measures, they're going to recreate the curriculum and the way class time is spent to focus on getting kids to have higher scores.
It seems to me that most private schools, and maybe I'm completely wrong about this, but I'm going to take a guess and say that most private schools tend toward the progressive side of the education. They don't focus on teaching to the test. And public schools, you say the dominant mode has been holding teachers accountable. Public schools have done this, and this has become ever more acute in the current time. If private schools are so great, why are they doing progressive education in the minds, let's say, of people who think that teacher accountability is more important?
Well, when I'm asked to reflect on the differences between private and public schools, I always start out with the fact that 90% of all American children are enrolled in public schools. And of the 10%, the vast majority are in parochial or religious schools, the 10% in private schools. And only 1 or 2% of that 10% are in independent private schools of the type that have the progressive sort of curriculum and progressive pedagogy that you're thinking of. But, you know, a lot of reformers who are interested in public schools were educated themselves in those types of independent private schools. John Dewey is an example of someone who had a lot of progressive ideas about education, and he started the lab school at the University of Chicago and was able to implement those ideas there. And it was just always very difficult to implement those ideas in public schools. I mean, one of the big reasons why is large class sizes. It's very, very difficult to have a lot of, you know, group activity and project-based learning and all of this when you have, you know, in the turn of the century Chicago, for example, 60 or 70 kids in a class. So often the types of things that, you know, private schools are doing are not feasible given the lack of resources in the public system.
That lack of resources is really key. There's a common phrase that is thrown around. We shouldn't have to be throwing money. We're throwing money at schools and it's not doing anything. I think I even read this again just a day or two ago, somebody else making that charge. Throwing money at schools is not going to make any difference. What's your take on that? And what have you seen as looking at the history of education reform, what lessons have you drawn from that in terms of this issue?
Well, our schools that educate our poor children have been chronically underfunded. There is no equity in funding in most American states between poor schools and middle class or affluent public schools. So I think that's just a basic fact we need to start out with. Now, if we look internationally, we do see that Americans, on average, we spend more per pupil than other nations and have poorer results. But when we look at that, we need to also consider the fact that we have about a fifth of our children living in poverty. We're talking about child poverty rates under 10% in most of the Western European and Asian nations that we are comparing ourselves to constantly. And that when we take children who have so many needs outside the classroom into the public education sector, they're not necessarily going to be able to be educated on the cheap because they have all these other needs that also, you know, need to get taken care of. We also know that states with higher teacher pay have better results. I mean, you have to look not just at the amount of money, but how the money is being spent. There's all sorts of things within the public education system that money is spent on, whether it's high-paid consultants, lots of bureaucrats in the central office, huge amounts of new standardized tests that get rolled out every 5 years, and we can never seem to agree and stick with any system over the long haul. All of these types of things are very expensive, and they don't necessarily positively impact student outcomes. Mm.
Okay, so I think you've really laid out the territory pretty well for us here, and I will want to go back to zero in on some of the points that you've made later on, but let's go back to the history, because I love history, and I loved how you laid it out from step to step. Let's go all the way back to Catherine Beecher. I believe she was the sister of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tell us about Catherine Beecher, and what did she do, and what was the aim of her idea of education?
Well, she and her sister Harriet were the daughters of Lyman Beecher, who was this strict fire and brimstone Calvinist preacher. And yet they grew up in a progressive social environment. They were interested in abolition and rights for Native Americans and other social causes. And what happens to Catherine Beecher is that her fiancé dies in a shipwreck and drowns. And in her early 20s, she's not sure what her future will hold. And so what she does is she goes into teaching, which is considered, you know, really one of the only socially acceptable things a young woman can do. But this isn't at the time public school teaching. At the time in the early 19th century, most public school teachers are men. And the sort of acceptable teaching job for a woman would be to teach sewing or music at a private girls' academy. And that's what Catherine's doing. And she has a vision of the woman as the ideal public school teacher. She recognizes that there's this common schools movement afoot, which in the 1830s, for the first time, is making this case that education should be publicly funded and compulsory, that parents should have to send their kids to school, and that states should guarantee this as a right, and it should be free for families. And Catherine says that women are the ideal educators in these new common schools because they are more moral than men, that they're almost biologically suited to be guiding children. And just as the mother works with children in the home, the teacher works with children in the school. So this is the vision she sets out. And it is very attractive to male policymakers like Horace Mann, who is the nation's first state secretary of education in Massachusetts, and he is a national leader in the common schools movement. They're trying to do common schools education reform without raising taxes all that much. And hiring women to be teachers allows them to do this because you can pay women at that time half as much as you can pay a male teacher.
And she also had a different idea of the kind of education that women should get.
Well, this goes back to your earlier question about private schools, actually, because when she started her own private school in Hartford for young women, she was teaching a very high-level liberal arts curriculum. But then when she became a sort of public intellectual going around the country making this case for women as public school teachers, she kind of moved away from that idea of an intellectual liberal arts curriculum, and she started talking about how moral education is much more important than math and science and literature. So the sort of ideas that she brought to her private school were not actually the ones that she advocated for the public system.
And you mentioned the word moral. Throughout this book, Dana Goldstein, throughout The Teacher Wars, you write about the moral panic that attends the idea of teachers and education and the whole idea that there is a moral issue at stake here in education. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so the concept of moral panic is one that I borrow from sociologists. And they've written about this in the context of welfare mothers, for example, who were you know, accused of being on crack or just sucking up public dollars and having more and more babies. And what was the welfare mother sort of panic in the 80s really about? You know, it was about anxiety about public spending on poor women of color. And what I saw is that as we come into the new millennium, public school teachers are more and more the source of this type of moral panic. It's the idea that if we can only fix public school teachers and get new teachers into the classroom and get rid of all these old horrible teachers, we're going to find our way to a more equal society. We're going to be able to attack inequality and have huge macroeconomic growth. And a lot of claims are made that are based on untested theories in terms of the impact of teachers on the economy. And I really saw this level of anxiety is not necessarily all that evidence-based.
Well, tell us a little bit about teachers. Why is it not evidence-based? A lot of people complain that, you know, teachers don't know enough to teach, that teachers' colleges are very inferior. The Teach for America program, I think, came out of some of that moral panic about teaching and teachers, you know, throwing young, elite, educated students into the classroom and thinking that they would do a better job. I know this is a complicated subject, but I wonder if you could kind of deconstruct this and tell us, you know, what did you find about teachers? What did you find about experienced teachers? What did you find about teachers who teach in poor schools? And then we'll talk about TFA.
Well, that's about 25 different questions, but I'll do my best with that. Certainly, there are deficiencies in teacher education, and it really dates back to the birth of the normal schools in the 19th century. These original teachers' colleges, if you want to call them that, actually accepted girls as young as 6th or 7th grade and gave them 1 or 2 years or sometimes even less than a year of training and then spat them right back out to be elementary school teachers. So these normal schools were really, you know, taking adolescents and then putting them right back as still adolescents into schools as teachers. And over time, these normal schools became many of today's state teacher colleges. And these state teacher colleges tend to still have, you know, pretty mediocre academic standards. We know that teachers are about average or a little bit below average academically if you look at their GPAs and their SAT scores. But the big problem with teacher education is that not enough prospective teachers have real time to learn skills in real classrooms working with real kids under the guidance of a veteran educator who can teach novices. You know, there's not a lot of opportunity in this entire system of teacher training and teacher development that we've created for teachers to collaborate with other colleagues and have adult-adult learning. And, you know, too often teacher education has been very theoretical and not practical in this way. So, you know, we know that when teachers do collaborate, it does lead to better results often for children, and that's what other nations have done. They've built those sorts of systems. In terms of veteran educators versus novices, you know, this Teach for America model, is it better to bring in, you know, elite young graduates from Harvard? Are they going to be better teachers? The evidence from Teach for America shows that its teachers are a little bit better at math than the typical veteran educator, and they're about the same with reading and literature. They're maybe about 3 percentage points better than the typical teacher when it comes to middle school math, for example, one study shows. The most important thing to realize about Teach for America is the incredibly small scale of this program. There's about 12,000 Teach for America teachers working right now compared to 3.4 million American educators. Every year, schools hire 100 to 200,000 new teachers, and low-income schools alone hire 70,000 new teachers per year. So even if every single person in America who graduated from a selective college every May became a public school teacher, we would not have enough public school teachers to satisfy the huge demand. So we cannot pursue solely a strategy of recruiting more elite people into the profession. That might be one way that we go about this, but truly we need to work on improving the skills of the people who are already teaching, because there are so many teachers. We cannot fire or recruit our way to success here. You know, we need to have an actual skills building strategy.
I was a teacher for many years. I was a teacher in higher education or adults, adult learners. So it's not quite the same, but I think that there, in fact, are a lot of skills that you learn teaching adults, specific skills about teaching that would apply to everybody. I came up in the kind of popular education movement, which had a lot to do with, it was participatory education. It's not just lecturing in the front of a classroom. And I can say, after the decades of teaching that I did, that I think teaching is an art. Pedagogy is an art in itself, and I have a hard time imagining why novice teachers from elite universities who may be very good in the subjects that they may be teaching actually know how to teach. Am I totally off base?
Well, I think the fact that novice teachers from Teach for America with just 5 weeks of training are able to outperform veteran teachers in math reflects two things. First of all, math seems to be more sensitive to the teacher's own educational background than English is. So, for example, a teacher of math, it's more important that they took some high-level math classes themselves in order to be able to successfully teach it than a teacher, say, of history or literature. At least that's what the data seems to show. But secondly, the fact that someone with 5 weeks of training can outperform or be just about the same as someone who may be the graduate of a four-year teacher's college program, it's really an indictment, I think, on those status quo programs. I mean, they're not giving those practical skills that you mentioned that are so important. Some of them are, but many of them are not. And so we need to look at the entire system. The lesson of these studies on Teach for America is not that Teach for America is the answer. It's that the entire system has a long way to go to improve.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dana Goldstein about her terrific book, The Teacher Wars. It's a history of America's most embattled profession. Another large issue, and in fact, subtext of a lot of education reform, is race and racism and segregation and desegregation. Well, desegregation is pretty much gone by the wayside, I'd say, in contemporary America. But let's go back in time to the movement to teach African Americans that happened just during and after the Civil War. Talk about Charlotte Fortin and some of the experiments that were done there and then got closed down. And then we'll follow up from there on some of the further history.
During the years after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, there was really a flowering of African-American education in the South. You have to remember, of course, that it was illegal to teach a black person to read or write in most of the states of the Confederacy. So when we're talking about a flowering of education for African Americans, we're talking about coming from really nothing, worse than nothing. That's what slavery was in terms of the educational development of most African Americans in the South. So Charlotte Fortin is an extraordinary young woman. She's a black woman from Philadelphia, and she's the fifth generation of Fortins to be born free. And she comes from an upper-class background, which is very unusual at the time. And she, during the Civil War, is called by this missionary request that comes north for young teachers to come south and teach the children and grandchildren of slaves in areas that the Union Army has taken over. And so she goes to the Sea Islands, which are off the coast of the Carolinas, and she teaches slaves in this really tiny, poorly supplied, poorly maintained one-room schoolhouse. And she really has an experience that shapes the rest of her life because she understands for the first time how very difficult it is to teach a child an academic curriculum when they are coming from nothing, when they are coming from, you know, the worst sort of grinding poverty. In fact, these are children who'd been as slaves picking cotton in the fields just weeks before she meets them. And she's just one of many young African-Americans from the North who has this experience. And, you know, we think of people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. They both taught black primary schools. And they're all part of a fertile debate and conversation among black educators about what is the best way to teach African-American children, and also what is the role of the teacher within the black community.
So say more about that. What was that debate, both about how to teach and what the role of the teacher was?
So both Du Bois and Washington, who are often portrayed as being two people who disagreed with each other passionately, because Booker T. Washington supported a more vocational education for African Americans, and Du Bois talked about the talented 10% of black people in the South who were able to go to college and should be groomed for a liberal arts education. What they actually agreed about very much was that teaching is pretty much the highest calling for a Black professional, and that it is this missionary job. And the term that is often used in the late 19th century is to uplift the race. Teachers uplift the African-American race, and Du Bois says the teacher and the preacher are the two most sacred callings within the Black community. So really, although teaching is often denigrated in white American culture, especially politically, you see Washington, Du Bois, Fortin, Anna Julia Cooper, another trailblazing Black educator I write about in the book. There's no sense from these people in the African-American community that teaching is denigrated. To the contrary, it is the most respected thing that a person can do. Where Du Bois and Washington disagree about teachers is that Du Bois very much sees them as part of the talented tenth. He's a critic of traditional teacher education at normal colleges, which we were just discussing, these low-level normal schools. And he really wants to make sure that the teachers who are working with Black children have been to college and had a liberal arts education, because he wants them to be able to open children's eyes up to the wider world. And he writes that the teachers of Black children need to be able to introduce Black children to white dominant culture, that they need to play this sort of translator role. And Booker T. Washington has a different vision, you know, looking at the need to open Black schools all across the South, you know, for many, many children who've never had any education. He's more pragmatic, and he believes it's fine that the teachers of Black children should have maybe mostly a vocational type of education, maybe the equivalent of a modern middle school education, and they can then go out and open a school. So this is some of the conflict that these two men have.
So that's a conflict between kind of, vocational education and a liberal arts education in some ways, between, you know, bootstrapping one's way up versus a small elite joining the larger society. How have you seen that debate, or have you seen that debate have echoes or play out in 20th and 21st century American education reform battles?
Well, vocational education has really, I think in some ways, unfortunately, become quite stigmatized. Now, the history of vocational education is really problematic. We see that again and again, Black students and Latino students and girls are directed toward lower-level vocational paths, and it is white males that have the most access to the liberal arts curriculum and to college. So there's good reason why vocational education became less and less popular alongside demands for civil rights for all these groups. I think one of the unfortunate things about that is we've now kind of settled into a system, especially in American high schools, of de facto unacknowledged tracking. So with all of the different honors classes and AP courses, we have this rhetoric of college for all, but actually we've created a system in which, you know, only some kids are getting this rigorous education that leads to a four-year college. And for those who aren't really getting that, we don't have any vocational options for them because vocational options have become so stigmatized in many places. I mean, there are schools in the United States that are doing a good job with vocational type education, but they are few and far between.
Hmm. And yet there does seem to be this whole push for STEM education. And if you look at New York, for example, you'll see, you know, every other middle school or high school seems to be connected to some kind of professional training.
Yeah, so I think you have to look at the quality of those programs and to what extent the rhetoric around STEM and connections to career, you know, you often use this phrase college and career readiness. And then when you dive down into it, you see that American students, compared especially to students in countries like Switzerland and Germany, they have almost no opportunities to spend part of their school year, say, doing a professional internship or an apprenticeship. You know, these concepts are very much reserved for the elite in American life, and they're just part of the typical high school course of events in other nations. I mean, schools actually provide and make sure that students are having professional experiences.
Right. In this country, the only people who can afford to be interns are people who have trust funds or parents who are supporting them.
Yes, exactly. And as someone who was able to do sort of unpaid internships and really became a journalist through doing apprenticeship type programs myself, I'm well aware of the power of being able to do that, and too few American students have those opportunities.
You also talked about how teaching is an honored profession in the African American community. Talk about how that translates into the quality of African American teachers in schools. You say they actually tend to be master, well, maybe that's I'm not sure if that's overblowing it, but you say they tend to be quite good teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of, the general public doesn't get that view of Black teachers. Talk about that and how the charter movement and the fights over education now, what kind of impact they're having on African-American teachers.
Well, what we do know about Black teachers is they appear to have a somewhat larger impact on the performance of Black students. So I wouldn't go so far as to say that all Black teachers are master teachers or Black teachers are more likely than white teachers to be master teachers. But we do know that there is something that happens when a child of color has a teacher of color who can kind of share their identity and understands their community and where they're coming from. And that can be, quite powerful in terms of student achievement. We also know that there's a very strong Black teaching tradition in American life, and this is something I write about in the book. You know, today's charter schools have really embraced this mantra of no excuses, the idea that you need to hold children to very high expectations academically and behaviorally, that schools should have strict discipline, students should wear uniforms, they should march through the hallways in lines. These are tactics that actually Black educators have embraced, going back to the 19th century. And some of the Black teachers over history who have used these tactics, like Anna Julia Cooper, who I write about in the book, saw them as a way to prepare Black children for the racist white world that they were going to be going into. You have to be extra well-behaved and extra orderly because you're going into a world as a Black adult that isn't going to give you a lot of second chances. And so the No Excuses Charter School movement of today, although it is a multiracial movement, you see it borrowing from ideas that Black educators have embraced for a very, very long time. However, most of the teachers and most of the leaders in many of these charter schools are white. And so what I bring up when I talk about this is that, when someone from your own community tells you no excuses, it's a bit different than when someone from outside of your community tells you no excuses. So it's one of the many, many reasons why it's important to recruit more Black educators to the profession.
Dana Goldstein. We'll talk more about her book, The Teacher Wars, after the break. Stick around.
There is a peaceful solution called a peace revolution. And now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in it, but I know we can win it. So let's just take back America. There was a dream, so believe it. Now get ready to receive it, and we'll take back America. And when the war is over and we've won it, let's remember how we done it so we don't have to do it again. There is a peaceful solution called a peace revolution, and now let's take back America.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist Dana Goldstein about her terrific new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. It's a groundbreaking study of the recurrent controversies in school reform and the lessons that we can draw from them to create some real solutions. My granddaughter, who's 10, is going to be going into middle school, and her closest middle school is one of the KIPP schools. It's in Bedford-Stuyvesant. And I believe they have the highest test scores of any school, public or private, in New York City, which would seem to make it attractive. But it's one of these schools that is extremely, strict. And the school that she goes to now, which is also predominantly African-American, but not as much as the KIPP school, which I think is like 95 or 97% African-American. The public school she goes to is about 85% African-American. Is, I'd say, a progressive school and also an extremely good public school, not a charter school. It's a national blue ribbon school, as a matter of fact. You couldn't imagine more of a contrast between the two. So it seems to me that success does not necessarily lie with this strictness. And charter schools themselves have been found to be, in general, no better than public schools. What's your take on this kind of contrast?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So research on the charter school sector shows that although some of the best top charter schools are among the best schools we have, especially for teaching poor children of color, on average, charter schools are average, just like regular traditional neighborhood public schools. And you can't generalize in any way to say charter schools are better or worse than public schools. It really is case by case. And there's also a lot of diversity within the charter school movement. The charter schools that tend to get the most attention, like the KIPP schools, the Knowledge is Power program schools, those schools are these no-excuses schools that I was explaining before that do focus on strict discipline, and they often very much focus on raising children's standardized test scores. And because of that, they do quite a lot of test prep, which we know test prep is not very popular with middle-class parents. It's something that middle-class families tend to try to avoid. But there are other charter schools in New York City. There are schools like Community Roots that are progressive schools. So there's a lot of diversity within the charter school sector, and both in terms of quality and in terms of pedagogical theories or ideas about how to teach children.
Now, the charter schools have been criticized by many, among them Diane Ravitch, who started out supporting strict accountability standards, high-stakes testing, and now has turned against it, have been charged with being a kind of boondoggle, a way to provide huge profits to educational corporations, to for-profit charter schools, to the whole testing industry, Pearson and all those. What do you feel about that? In other words, there's the issue of education reform, and then there's what happens to it in a capitalist marketplace.
Well, it's important to understand that the vast, vast majority of charter schools are public schools. They are not created to provide profit to anyone. There are states that do allow for-profit charter schools, such as Michigan, for example, but that is not most states. In New York, for example, we do not have for-profit charter schools. I mentioned New York because that's where I'm based. I think where this sometimes gets confusing is that a lot of the powerful philanthropists who have given money to jumpstart the charter school movement, like Bill Gates and Eli Broad, the real estate magnate, they do come from the private sector and they are corporate philanthropists. However, they're not doing this because they see an opportunity for themselves to gain money from this. Bill Gates has all of the money he needs. They're doing it because the idea of charter schools and creating a competitive marketplace where traditional public schools need to compete for students with charter schools, like the two middle schools you described, you know, the one your granddaughter goes to and the KIPP school nearby. This idea of a competitive landscape in public education is something that is so innately appealing to corporate leaders like Bill Gates, that this vision is something that they're attracted to. And so truly, I think the charter school movement and its relationship to the business world is more of an ideological relationship than one that's motivated primarily by profit.
And yet the high-stakes testing has meant a huge explosion in the testing industry, which is highly profitable.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there are certainly companies like McGraw-Hill and Pearson who are making a large profit as we transition to a new generation of standardized tests. And it is folks like Bill Gates who support standardized testing. But you have to, again, kind of pull the threads apart. So why does someone like Bill Gates support standardized testing? He supports it because he's trying to collect data that would allow him to judge teachers. And his goal is to get rid of ineffective teachers or to improve their skills. And he believes that you can accurately figure out which teachers are bad and which are good by looking at their students' standardized test scores. And thus, he wants there to be new, better tests. And then you have the textbook and the test makers like Pearson and McGraw that come in and they create these products. And they are the ones that stand to draw profit from it.
You criticize the idea, the notion that high-stakes testing the way it's done is actually effective.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think high-stakes standardized tests, when you tie a lot of adult accountability measures for teachers and principals to scores on these tests, basically what you're creating is a system in which test prep can become the de facto curriculum in schools. And this especially happens in poor children's schools because those are the schools that are under the most pressure politically to raise test scores. And so this is just a simple situation of perverse incentives. And it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be testing in our schools. We need to have testing to know what children do and don't know. But it means that we need to be careful about tying too much adult accountability measures to testing.
Do you think it makes sense to have testing but not high stakes attached to it?
Yes, that is in fact exactly what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't really talked about unions, but they're a very important part of this story. Some charter schools are unionized, but most are not. A couple of years ago in Chicago, we had Mayor Rahm Emanuel threaten to close down scores of schools because they were not performing correctly. And of course, this is significant because he's so tied to Obama, as is the Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who was in Chicago for, you know, I don't know his exact title, commissioner of the schools or something there. But, you know, they've gotten fully behind this kind of high-stakes testing, and it came to a head in Chicago. What was your take on what happened there in Chicago?
Well, Chicago is just one of many cities that have decided to try to shut down persistently failing schools. And the way they measure typically how a school is failing is whether it has had low test scores year after year. So we've seen New York, for example, do this. We've seen Chicago do this. We've seen Washington, D.C. do this. What we know from Chicago is that most of the kids whose schools were shut down ended up in another failing school. They ended up in another school that was very low performing. And so this creates a sort of, you know, disturbing cycle where the poorest kids that are most likely to be in bad schools are sort of shuttled from one bad school to the next. For most of them, you're not actually improving the quality of the school they attend, but you're creating a whole lot of turmoil around their lives. And of course, you know, you're only in high school for 4 years. It's a very short period of time. And, you know, there is persuasive research showing that a lot of school switching can have its own depressive effect on student achievement. So, you know, a lot of folks are saying, instead of shutting down these schools, what about providing them with more resources, really flooding them with support, making sure they have a good curriculum, making sure they have great principals, trying to do more to incentivize the best teachers to work in these schools. So that is kind of an alternative to the Rahm Emanuel strategy of shutdowns.
Sounds like a no-brainer. The other thing that happened there is that there was a real coming together of the community and parents in support of the Chicago teachers' strike.
That's something I write about in the book because it was something that was so surprising to many politicos. When Chicago teachers in 2012 went on strike for over a week, the assumption was that parents would be outraged. Of course, it's very difficult when your kids can't go to school. You have to arrange alternative, you know, child care arrangements and all of this. But actually, the majority of parents were quite supportive of the strike, and Black and Latino parents were even more likely to be supportive of the unions than white parents were. So this kind of complicated the political narrative that we're often told, which is that, you know, poor parents of color are angry at teachers' unions and they blame bad teachers for bad schools. And in fact, that's not the case. We know that parents of color and poor parents are quite sympathetic toward unions and teachers' unions. And they would like to see education reform done in partnership with unions, not as an attack on unions.
And did they also see that what Rahm Emanuel was doing was in some way trying to wrest away community control of schools? Maybe not formal community control, but in the sense that schools like the ones in Chicago, and I know like the one that my granddaughter goes to, are very much seen as community resources by the parents.
Yeah, this is such an important point, and it's something I've written about most in a detailed way in Washington, D.C., with school closures there. But when you close down a neighborhood school, you're not just getting rid of a place that has bad test scores. You're taking away the school that maybe your mother and your grandmother attended, and that is the place where everyone has fond memories of going to a football game, or where there was a program after school that was really meaningful to your brother, and your parents would like you to enroll in that program too. So schools are sort of the beating hearts within their neighborhoods, and the closure movement, although well-intended, I think it perceived schools as achievement factories. If the kids are not getting high test scores, it's okay to shut this factory down because the factory is not creating a good product. But actually, parents and families perceive schools in a completely different way. You know, they don't see them primarily as producers of test scores. They see them as community centers.
It's kind of the Bain Capital approach to education.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't talked about the Common Core, and this is, you know, if you say that, as you say in your book, Dana Goldstein, as you say in The Teacher Wars, that teachers are politicized, that the whole idea of teachers and education is, boy, the Common Core is super politicized. It's a complicated issue, and it's one that's actually uniting people on the left and right against, although I'm going to say right up front that I think the idea of the Common Core standards is fantastic. I've seen them in practice. I've seen a whole shift away from rote learning to critical thinking, and I support it, but a whole lot of people are against it.
Yes, and I agree with you. The standards themselves are excellent, and I think that they do represent an infusion of rigor and intellectual seriousness, potentially, into many schools, that they really do focus on reading at a high level, writing at a high level, doing, you know, math in greater depth, so not covering 100 math topics in a year, but 10 really in depth so that kids have a true understanding of math, which we know is a particular weakness of American schools. So I certainly support the idea of common standards. We know that the United States up until now has been one of the only Western nations to lack any sort of common standards for our schools. So this is potentially a positive step forward. I think the reason why they're so controversial on both the left and the right, for the left, it really has to do with the standardized testing element of this. The standards are not just curriculum standards. They also come with a lot of new standardized tests. And in particular, the test scores are going to be used to evaluate and judge teachers and principals. And so parents are concerned it's going to lead to teaching to the test. And this is now a big testing opt-out movement on the left among certain parents. Now, on the right, it's a bit different. The standards are being kind of caricatured as a federal intervention in local schools and an example of big government driven by President Obama. Actually, what's interesting about the Common Core standards is that the Obama administration had nothing to do with the creation of them. They were driven by the teachers' unions, by the Gates Foundation, that's Bill Gates' philanthropy, and by a bunch of state legislatures that decided one by one over the course of about a year in 2008, 2009, that they were going to adopt these things. And so it was a movement that had a lot of support from influential people, but really was a state-by-state type of a movement. Now, the way that the Obama administration got involved is that they provided federal incentives, so money, to states that agreed to link their standardized testing programs to these standards. So it's a bit complicated topic, but I think it might be the type of thing that's better in theory than in practice, but certainly the idea of high rigorous national standards is a good one.
Well, what comes to me is, again, this idea that perhaps we need to separate accountability from high stakes, because the Common Core itself, I mean, I can imagine some people perhaps on the right not wanting their kids to learn critical thinking skills. But on the other hand, you know, who could really argue against that? But as you say, the problem is how it's being put into practice.
Yeah, and I think you're right that if we could disconnect the idea of the Common Core from these very complex systems of evaluating teachers that incentivize test prep, then I think they would be a lot less controversial.
So we're coming to the last couple of minutes here. You did this amazing job of exploring the history of American education. This is a very cogent, fascinating, informative book, The Teacher Wars. So Dana Goldstein, what's your prescription for education reform?
That's a hard question, but what I basically conclude in the epilogue and the final chapter of the book is that we've very much in American history had the contention that teachers are the cause of all of our problems with education. But as this conversation that we just had displays, there are so many other issues, you know, the lack of a rigorous curriculum, unequal funding, all of these other things matter just as much, if not more, than individual teachers do. So what I suggest in the book is, instead of letting education reform be motivated by our fears of the worst teachers, we should let it be motivated by the actions of the best teachers. And what I mean by that is that we should find those teachers that are doing an excellent job despite all the inequities in this system, observe their classrooms, and build systems that allow them to train other teachers to do the things they're doing that are successful. One of the things we know about American teachers is that compared to teachers in other countries, they spend way more of their day in front of children and way less of their day in collaboration with other adults. And teachers need that collaborative time with other adults to learn skills, to lesson plan with other teachers, to strategize about how to reach students that are particularly hard to teach. This is something we need to build into our system. These types of collaborative professional development systems are something we've never built. Instead, we focused on judging, rating, ranking, testing. We need to take the focus away from all that a little bit and focus more on improving instruction through giving teachers the time and the space to collaborate to improve their skills.
Well, Dana Goldstein, thank you so much for talking with us here about your terrific book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Dana Goldstein is a staff writer at The Marshall Project, a nonpartisan news organization dedicated to covering America's criminal justice system. She also writes for The Atlantic and Slate, among other venues. On October 6, Nation editor and publisher Katrina VandenHeuvel and contributing editor Stephen F. Cohen sat down in Moscow for a wide-ranging discussion with Edward Snowden, where Snowden shared his thoughts on the surveillance state, the American political system, and the price he's paid for his understanding of patriotism. The conversation lasted for nearly 4 hours and has been distilled into an in-depth article in this week's edition of The Nation magazine. I spoke with Katrina VandenHeuvel about her interview with Snowden, as well as her thoughts on the impact the Snowden revelations have had on the U.S. press. We only have time here for a short clip from that interview, but you can find my entire conversation with Katrina VandenHeuvel at writersvoice.net. So, Katrina VandenHeuvel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on.
So, on October 6th, you and Stephen Cohen sat down in Moscow for a wide-ranging discussion with Edward Snowden. First of all, how did you find him, his mood, how was he doing?
He's in good spirits. Of course, he'd like to come home. He describes himself as living in exile, but he's built himself a studio, a kind of TV studio, so he can engage with the world. Just a few days after we met with him, he did a interview conversation with Jane Mayer for The New Yorker. He comes into South by Southwest festivals, TED Talks. He's engaged with Europe. He testified before the European Parliament. So he's sort of in a virtual reality, you know, in Moscow, able to move around. In fact, traveled to St. Petersburg, which, as your listeners may or may not know, is going from New York City to Los Angeles. And as we learn from a new documentary called Citizen 4, which came out last week, Snowden's girlfriend is now living there with him. But of course, a lot of care is being taken to try and, I think, find a way back through trial or some arrangement. Didn't want to talk too much about that. But he's certainly in a thoughtful mood, and I'd say our interview captures that. It's quite wide-ranging. It's not just about technology or encryption, but it's his thoughts about the political system, the failure of our media, the possibility of social movements, the work he's doing to craft a Magna Carta for the Internet. So there's a lot going on in his mind, and he's very articulate, seems older than his years. He looks very young, and it was an engaging, more spirited conversation. We thought he would be much more guarded, and those who've seen him on video, he looks quite stern, but he laughs easily. He was very engaged, and so it was, I thought, a valuable conversation with him.
Yes, I just saw Citizen 4. It's a terrific movie, and your interview is, for me, it was a fascinating follow-up to that. Now, you say a Magna Carta for the Internet? What is that?
So he's working with a man some of your listeners may know named Tim Berners-Lee, who's considered the sort of founder of the World Wide Web. And the belief is that even if you reform a nation's laws, that the digital rights will still be under siege. So they're crafting digital rights and question of what values should we be protecting. He believes if even countries pass the best surveillance reforms, the best privacy protections, it might have zero impact internationally. This becomes a kind of, you know, a set of laws for the technical system, for technical standards. I don't know how truly effective this will be, but it is something he cares deeply about. And he also says, I have a somewhat sneaky way of affecting political change. I don't want to directly confront great powers, which we cannot defeat on their terms. They have more money, more clout, more airtime. But he does see this engaging with this new system of digital rights as a way to bring pressure on the powers that be. He's thinking very broadly about power. He's very critical. I thought one of the most interesting things was where he spoke. You know, he says he withheld moving on his disclosures prior to Obama's election in 2008 because he had hope of real change coming out of the post-George W. Bush 9/11 moment, which he sees as the kind of original sin, toxic destruction of a constitutional order. But he feels that perhaps the biggest disappointment he believes of the Obama administration won't be related to social or economic policies, but the fact that he's led a culture of immunity continue. That is, that he said, the president said, let's go forward, not backward, in regard to the violations of law that occurred under the Bush administration. And he's very, one of, I think, a formative moment for Snowden was when National Director of Intelligence James Clapper testified before Congress, gave false statement, a lie to Congress about whether the NSA was gathering data on Americans. And he feels that in allowing Clapper to continue in his office without any accountability, breaking the law, facing no consequences, this culture of immunity, this end of accountability, is a kind of metastasizing cancer in our system.
He talks about the companies and how the U.S. has been dealing with them. One thing I found, I was a bit surprised at, is he says the companies didn't know that the NSA was going into the back door of them. Talk about that. And also, you discuss the new iPhone 6, you know, its encryption capabilities and his take on those.
Yeah, I mean, we brought up the iPhone. I'll just begin there if I could, because in some of the coverage of its launch, I don't know if your listeners remember, but the headlines were, you know, kind of the post-Snowden revelations phone, because the iPhone has encryption technology. He believes that the government, the Attorney General and FBI in particular, are trying to create a kind of manufactured crisis which doesn't exist, because, in fact, through lawful warrants, you still have access to the phone. It doesn't stop law enforcement, the encryption in the iPhone 6, from tracking your movements via geolocation on the phone, for if they think you're, for example, involved in trafficking or kidnapping. And it doesn't stop law enforcement, he asserts, from requesting copies of your texts from the providers via warrant. And then you can also, through the cloud system, pictures that are accessible, et cetera. So he's pushing back on that. But he does say, yes, that the companies did know and then did not know. I mean, but he's saying that as a result of his revelations, the companies, many of them like Yahoo or Google, are pushing back, because maybe it's not a moral issue for them, but it's a business issue, and they feel that they were compliant in many ways in terms of allowing the government to use the, quote, front door, which is more accessible, but then the government was also playing with their back door. Don't push me too hard on this. One of the things Stephen Cohen and I, this interview was 35,000 words. It now runs 9,000 words in The Nation at thenation.com. But he is a techie. I mean, there's no question. And he kind of lowers his head and goes into a semi-trance. We are not as engaged with that community. And also, we felt the interview needed to kind of be more broad-gauged, just for the nature of our audience. And because he's talked in so many other places about the tech issues. But I do think there's a broad democracy issue about the engagement of our major internet companies with the government. And I think his revelations, as in so many other areas, have reset that relationship so that the companies are more guarded, more cautious, more careful, and less willing to be as compliant as they were when the government said, for national security, for other reasons, you must work with us or allow us access.
Nation editor and publisher Katrina VandenHeuvel. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of our conversation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.